Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
As promised, we're going to begin the book of Numbers tonight. And as the name implies, it's a book full of
numbers.
Exactly.
And
lots of begatting as well.
See, sweet Sally, she remembered the begatting.
No.
I know about begatting.
Your reputation is just taking a downhill plunge today.
I don't. Shut up.
Quit while you're ahead.
I'll never get ahead.
So, as we think about the sequence of the first five books of the Bible, this is another book that is accredited to Moses. And as the book of Exodus got the children of Israel out of Egypt, the book of Leviticus took place all at Mount Sinai, God giving them the rules by which they were going to live once they came into the Promised Land, and the rules for building a tabernacle and constructing the priesthood and introducing concepts like substitutionary atonement. We're going to see more of that as the book of Numbers gets underway. And then at the end of the book of Leviticus, we had just learned things like the Sabbaths and the seven-year Sabbaths and the Jubilee year, and that in the year of Jubilee, once everyone was given their property in the Promised Land, in the year of Jubilee, everything would revert back to how God had originally established it. And that's a real important point, too, as you go into the book of Numbers, because part of the counting that takes place in the book of Numbers is to determine the size and the strength of the 12 tribes. There's actually, at this moment, 13, because you've got two of Joseph's sons that are each representing a tribe. And then you've got the Levites who aren't going to get a land inheritance. So you have the 12 tribes that are inheriting some land. And there's a count going on at the beginning of the book of Numbers. There's actually two of these censuses that are taken in the book of Numbers. One right at the beginning when God says, count each tribe, men 20 and up, ones who are able to fight, ones who are able to make up a standing army. So it determines the strength of Israel. It also gives us a good idea how many people came out of Egypt, because this first census is being taken just as they're leaving Mount Sinai and preparing to go for the first time to the very edge of the land of Canaan. And so the book of Numbers is going to get that journey started as well. And then some 37 years later, they take another count. Because now as they've gone through their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, the first generation has died off, and the younger generation, the second generation to come out of Egypt, is about to enter the Promised Land. And so they stop and count again. Let's find out what our strength is, how many men, how big is our army. But it also serves to determine the relative size of each individual tribe so that as the land allotments are being laid out, an appropriate amount of land is given to each of the tribes based on their numbers and on their relative strength. The end of the book of Leviticus, there's one more chapter that we didn't really cover, and so we're just going to kind of scan through it for a moment. The end of the book of Leviticus, chapter 27, is about rules concerning valuations. One of the principles that is connected to the year of Jubilee is the ability to buy back or redeem property that is rightfully yours. If you lost your property or you lost your home, lost your land, or even yourself or a relative over the course of the 50 years between Jubilees, if you had to sell yourself into slavery or sell your property, it was always yours. It still belonged to your family. It belonged to your tribe. And so the value of your own life or your property or your house was determined based on how many years it would be until the next Jubilee. And those rules were all written into the book of Leviticus as well. Well, then God lays out some basic valuations for the priests to go by. The priests were not allowed to just kind of look at people and say, Tom, no, he's worth $18. And Charlie, $27. And, you know, Conrad, $1.50. You know, they weren't. Sorry. If you didn't see that coming, I don't. You don't know me. If you didn't, that was bound to happen. And so God lays out at the very end of the book of Leviticus some actual valuations. And they're going to come into play. It's necessary that we understand this valuation, because God's going to restrict himself to these very same rules in the book of Numbers. So, again, chapter 27, verse 1, again the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man makes a difficult vow, he shall be valued according to the valuation of persons who are belonging to the Lord. If your valuation is of a male from 20 years even to 60 years old, then your valuation shall be 50 shekels of silver."
Seven more years.
I'm still valuable for seven more years.
Valuable for 7 more years.
That's good to know. Now, if we're going to use these rules to determine the relative value of people, we're about to get into women, so I'll let you deal with it. If it is a female, then she has the valuation of 30 shekels. And if it be from 5 years even to 20 years old, then your valuation for the male should be 20 shekels, and for the female, 10 shekels. But if they are from a month even to 5 years old, then your valuation shall be 5 shekels of silver for the male, and for the female, your valuation shall be 3 shekels of silver. And if they are from 60 years old and upward, if it is a male, then your valuation will be 15 shekels, and the female, 10 shekels. But if he is poorer than your valuation, then he shall be placed before the priest, and the priest shall value him according to the means of the one who vowed, and the priest shall value him. Now, if it's an animal of the kind which men can present as an offering to the Lord, any such that one gives to the Lord shall be holy. He shall not replace it or exchange it, a good for a bad, or a bad for a good. Or if he does exchange animal for animal, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. If, however, it is any unclean animal of a kind which men do not present as an offering to the Lord, then he shall place the animal before the priest, and the priest shall value it as it is good or bad. As you, the priest, value it, so shall it be. We won't go through all these valuations, but he's going to go from there into a house. If you lose your home and want to redeem it, there are rules about how to do it. If you have a piece of land, there are rules about how to redeem it. But verse 17, if he consecrates his fields as of the year of Jubilee, according to your valuation it will stand. So this is all surrounding the idea of the year of Jubilee coming up. Take Jubilee into account and value land and property accordingly, because it's going to revert back to the people God originally gave it to. There are then a few rules at the very end about the priests valuing the year or a field according to the year. Verse 24, in the year of the Jubilee, the field shall return to the one from whom he bought it, to whom the possession of the land belongs. Every valuation of yours, moreover, shall be after the shekel of the sanctuary. In other words, he's saying, make sure that you only use one measurement when you determine shekels, so you can't have different weights and measures of how much a shekel is. And then he defines it. A shekel shall be 20 gerahs. That ought to clear it up for all of us. However, a firstborn among animals, which as a firstborn belongs to the Lord. Now hold on to this concept. Remember that when the Israelites were brought out of Egypt, that on the night that God delivered them, God killed all the firstborn in Egypt. All the firstborn humans and all the firstborn animals. And then God told Israel through Moses that all their firstborn, the firstborn of every person, the firstborn of every animal, belong to God. Firstborn males belong to God. So he's restating that same concept here about the firstborn animals, which are firstborn. They belong to the Lord, and no man may consecrate that, whether ox or sheep. It belongs to the Lord, so you couldn't buy that back. So God is really establishing again that the firstborn belongs to him, and he can do whatever he wants with it, and you couldn't redeem that back. But if it is among the unclean animals, then you shall redeem it according to your valuation, and add 1/5 to it. And if it is not redeemed, then it shall be sold according to your valuations. Nevertheless, anything which a man sets apart to the Lord out of all that he has, of man or animal, or of fields of his own property, shall not be sold or redeemed. Anything devoted to destruction, anything to be burned, anything that is sacrificed, is most holy to the Lord. No one who may have been set apart among men shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. Thus, all the tithe, or all the tenths of the land, and of the seed of the land, or of the fruit of the land, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord. If, therefore, a man wishes to redeem part of his tithe, he'll add to it yet another fifth. Because your tithe was your grain, your animals. If you wanted to redeem part of that back, you had to take the valuation of it plus another fifth in order to buy it back because it belonged to God. He is not to be concerned whether it's good or bad, nor shall he exchange it. Or if he does exchange it, then both it and its substitute shall become holy. It shall not be redeemed. These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the sons of Israel at Mount Sinai. That's the end of the book of Leviticus. I reviewed that all real quickly. You can go back and read the details if you're more interested. I reviewed that quickly because you need to remember those rules to understand what God is about to do. First, he's going to take account of everybody in Israel, but he's not going to count the Levites. The Levites then take a separate accounting. And then, because the number of Levites is essentially the same as the number of firstborn in Israel, he's going to make an exchange. And he's going to say, because the firstborn belong to me, just as you all belong to me, and because the firstborn are consecrated to me, I'm going to take the entire tribe of Levi and make them my separate, distinct people. And in so doing, I have redeemed all your firstborn back to you. So now the Israelites didn't need to bring their firstborn children or their firstborn animals even. Instead, the Levites and the Levites' animals all became God's firstborn. So God can really genuinely do whatever he wants with what is his. But he's also putting another principle in place. The same way that the book of Leviticus gave us the principle of substitutionary atonement, here is God again saying, I can take, for those that are mine, for those that are consecrated to me, I can take something else in their place. I will take the Levites, who are dedicated to my work and to my temple, and I will count them for my firstborn. And of course, that principle is going to move right into the New Testament, that we, the church, we who are the redeemed of God, God, rather than count our sin, rather than hold us responsible, says, I will take Christ in your place. And I will hold him accountable for your sin and punish him. And then I will take his righteousness and impute it to you. So God shows repeatedly, whether in the sin offerings, whether in the substitution of being able to put your hands on an animal and transfer guilt to the animal and then slay the animal or take the animal outside the camp. Here with the Levites and the firstborn, God is one more time showing his ability to substitute person for person. This is a concept that we call, throughout the Bible, we talk about imputation. When we talk about the fact that there are imputations in the Bible, it frustrates some people's traditions and theologies. Particularly, Pelagianism says that when Jesus died, he was simply an example of martyrdom, but that his righteousness is not imputed to humans. Nor was Adam's fall imputed to all mankind. Adam's fall was an individual fall. Therefore, salvation is based on every individual's attempt at personal righteousness. And you can be personally righteous because you're not dead in trespasses and sins because Adam's guilt was not imputed to you. They don't like the imputations. Adam's sin was not imputed to you, but either was Christ's righteousness imputed to you. But you now have a fair shot. And every human is born essentially neutral and capable. And if you're just good enough, If you just apply yourself sincerely enough over the course of your life, you can attain a level of personal righteousness where God will accept you on the basis of your righteousness. Now, if that sounds peculiar to you, there is this little religion floating around the world known as Catholicism. You may have heard of that before. At its essence, Catholic soteriology says that God does give people grace, but the grace he gives you is not a grace that makes you righteous. It's a grace he gives you that empowers you to be righteous on your own, to accomplish your own righteousness. So if you do enough good works, and then every time you sin, you go and confess your sins and say your Hail Marys and your Our Fathers and do enough penance for your sins, then you are taking care of your sin problem. You don't need Christ's imputation there. And you're taking care of your own righteousness, so you don't need Christ's imputation there. So when folks say, oh, well, there's no real Pelagianism in the world anymore, it actually lays at the very heart of Catholic theology, this idea that you can wipe out the biblical imputations in favor of human ability and human will and human desire. And it can be confusing sometimes because Pelagians will use the language of grace. And you have to listen carefully to what they're saying, because they'll say that God does give men grace, but then you need to make them define what they mean when they say God gives grace, because usually what they'll say is God gives you the grace to be capable of doing enough good that God will accept you on the basis of your own goodness and personal righteousness. Well, the concept of imputation is not a Reformed or Calvinistic invention, is my point. When Paul writes that Jesus became sin for us, that's an imputation. When he took our sin on himself and took it to the cross, that's an imputation. But when you saw substitutionary atonement in the sin sacrifice, the reason that hands were laid on the head of the animal was to impute the sins of the individual, or if it was the high priest putting his hands on the animal, it was the sins of all Israel being imputed to the animal, and then the animal dying as a substitute. Well, the same thing is going to happen in the book of Numbers, where you're going to see God say, these are mine, they're my firstborn, based on the fact that I killed all the firstborn of Egypt and I spared all your firstborn. But then God says, you know what? You won't find the words you know what in the text. But then God says, here's what we're going to do. Rather than every family in Israel having to give me their firstborn, I'm going to take one tribe. I'll take the tribe of Levi, and I am going to put them into service continually for me. They don't get a land inheritance, and 1/10, and actually by the time you add it all up, it gets more into the 20% and close to 30%, but big portions of the other 12 tribes' total gross domestic product ends up going to the Levites. So the Levites end up well cared for, plenty of food, but they don't get a land inheritance. So every 50 years when everything reverts back, the Levites have nothing to revert back to. Instead, they become a burden to Israel. And Israel is taxed through the tithes to pay for the Levites. And the Levites live off the temple and off the sacrifices of all the rest of Israel who have to bring their sacrifices. And God does that on purpose and says, I'm going to take this tribe to myself, and I'm going to do it to substitute for all the other firstborn who are mine, but I'm going to take these instead. Well, that is God saying, I can substitute if I want to, and I can impute if I want to. These ideas are not novel, they're not brand new, they're very biblical and they're very consistent. And so that is why we argue and have no problem with the notion that Adam's sin is imputed to all mankind. Paul certainly argues it when he says, all men die. And all men die because all men have Adam's sin imputed to them. So imputation, substitution, these are really important concepts, but they're introduced in the first 5 books of the Bible. That's my point. Got that? Mm-hmm. Yes, Charlie.
So there was nothing that Levi did. It was just God decided that they were going to
Yeah, it was nothing the Levites did. Now, that's an important point, too, because here again we see election. Here again we see God saying, okay, the firstborn are mine, but instead I'll have you. Which is why I think it's fascinating that Jesus is referred to in the New Testament as being elect. He's the chosen of God. He's the one that God chose and said, I will take him for all of you. I will punish him for all of you. I will accept his righteousness for all of you. And so God has always had this ability to pick and choose. It's the difference, Charlie, between election and selection. This is a really fine point. But people sometimes speak of biblical election as being a selecting that God does. But selection implies that there's goodness to the one you select. If you go to buy fruit, if your mom goes and buys fruit and you're with her, watch her next time. She'll squeeze things, she'll check the color, she'll look to see if anything's brown on the lettuce, and she'll select the best of what's there. I'm assuming that's true of you. Okay, maybe she just throws things in the cart. We don't know. I select, just so you know. But selection is not the way God works, because selection implies what you just asked, that there was some reason for God to choose them, that there was some quality in them, some ability they had, some uniqueness that made God say, I'm going to select out of all the tribes this one because they are the appropriate one. No, just the opposite. I mean, he chose Aaron and his sons to be high priest and then killed two of the sons. These were not the good ones. He chose Levi because he chose Levi.
Just like he chose David, and yet, you know, David with Bathsheba, and, you know, great man, but he did terrible things.
We can go right down the list, can't we? He chose Moses, and Moses killed an Egyptian slave master. So you can go right down the line and look at Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. Heel catcher, deceiver, supplanter. So it's not that God goes around selecting the good choices. He elects the ones that he wants. Now, was it fair for God to say, of these 13 tribes, 12 of you are going to get land in perpetuity? And every 50 years, the land I give you is going to go back to you. But you Levites, no land. Is it also fair for God to say, now, you other 12, a minimum of 10%, up to 28% of everything you make, all your best, the best of your fruit, the best of your field, the best of your seed, the best of your animals, the best of everything goes to the Levites. Well, that's going to make the Levites actually, in terms of possession, they're going to get richer than any individual other tribe. Because the other 12 tribes get to keep roughly 80% of whatever they make. But the Levites get 20% of what 12 tribes make. That makes more. Is that fair? Doesn't matter. The question of fairness never comes up. It's God saying, this is how you're going to do it, this is how you're going to do it, this is how you're going to do it. And to the Levites, he says, you're going to work continually for me, I'll take care of you. But notice how he takes care of them. He says, I'll take care of you by making sure that the other 12 tribes provide for you because you're working for me. And since you're working for me, I'm going to make sure that you can devote yourself to working for me by having the others provide for you. This is not a concept that is unique or new to the church. This is a concept that all the way through the Bible, God picks people and says, you work for me and I will provide for you through my other people. So that begins Chapter 1 of the book of Numbers. Actually, that introduces it, I suppose. Oh, I'm not going to get anywhere near where I was hoping to get tonight. Tonight might just end up being all introduction. So here's the first census. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, on the first day of the second month, in the second year, after they had come out of the land of Egypt. Now, why did Moses go through the trouble of telling you those exact time stamps and those exact dates? Well, if you go back and look at Exodus 40, I think it's verse 17, right around that area, if you do the math, what that tells you is God spoke to Moses here in the tent of meeting a month after the tent of meeting was finished being constructed. So here again, you can look at the internal evidence, you can compare book for book, and you'll find out that the numbers and the dates all line up. Now, they're also a year out of Egypt, which gives you some idea how long they've been at Mount Sinai, camped there, receiving rules, becoming a nation. And let me add this, too, because it'll flee my brain later. I mentioned that part of this census was to determine the fighting strength of the Israelites. And once they, as an army, as a people of a million strong, as they make their way toward the promised land, they're not going to take the promised land. They get right to the edge of it. They send in spies. The spies come back with a bad report of the land and say, oh, definitely, milk and honey, yes. Got everything we need, lots of food, flowing water, everything's good, but we also saw giants in the land, big people, and we're scared. And in fact, in our own eyes, we were so small, we were like grasshoppers before them. In other words, they'll just crush us. And so when they brought that evil report back to the people said, well, what are we going to do? Forget it. Now, they've had a year at Mount Sinai. They understand all the promises of God. God takes them right to the edge of the land and says, it's flowing with milk and honey, and I'll fight for you. I'll clear out your enemies. I'll clear out the wild animals. They should have gotten to the River Jordan and said, let's go. This is ours. This is clearly ours. And instead, as soon as a man says to them, despite what God has said, as soon as a man says to them, ooh, this looks dangerous, which you'll actually find in the text. He says, ooh, this looks dangerous. As soon as they hear that, there's only two, Joshua and Caleb, who say, yeah, but we're well able. Let's go take the land. Let's go get it. And the rest of the people say, no, we're good. Well, then God has them wandering in the wilderness. And so the purpose for the wandering in the wilderness is twofold. One is to take that first generation that came out of Egypt, who were raised in Egypt, who had all the mindset of Egypt, the Egyptian gods, the Egyptian form of worship. And these were the ones who were stubborn against the God of Israel. It was a way of just weeding them all out. He strews their bones through the wilderness and leaves them out there. The second thing is, this second generation, if you think about it, 20 and under, are all going to grow up in the wilderness every day in the vicinity of the Tent of Meeting and the tabernacle and God's presence. And so they're going to grow up only knowing that God. And they're going to grow up only knowing his rules. And they're going to grow up only knowing his religion. So it's a very different look to that group of people than the original group that comes out of Egypt. The original group that comes out of Egypt has all of that old Egyptian mindset and religion to get through. And they're stubborn and they're argumentative. But all the kids grow up knowing nothing but the religion of Yahweh. And what's remarkable is when you look at the census at the beginning and you look at the census at the end, it's essentially the same number. It's only off by a couple thousand. So God replaced the entire early generation, the older generation, with the second generation and replaced them man for man so that they're just as strong an army when they're ready to go in to take the promised land. And yet when they get to the edge of Jericho with all that counted up strength and with all those years of traveling in the wilderness, they're toughened. They're strong. They're ready to take the land. They're ready to fight now. They know only Yahweh. They're the second. They're the young generation. And they get to the first major city that they're going to have to conquer. They get to Jericho, and they're ready to go and fight and go to war. And what does God do? He says, now you all stand there. Watch this. And he makes them march around Jericho for 7 days. And on the seventh day, they blow their trumpets, break their lanterns, Jericho falls down. Did they have to go to war? No. No, God fights for them. So the one thing that the first generation refused to believe, that God would fight against the enemies for them, as soon as the second generation gets in, God does it and says, see? I'm right here. I'm doing it. If your forefathers would have believed me, they would have come in. But they didn't come in for lack of faith, and then, of course, through the New Testament, they are so frequently referred to because they're a perfect demonstration of people who had no faith in God's ability to protect them, to fight for them, to provide for them. So what you're going to see over the course of the book of Numbers is this gradual weaning and gradual killing of the older generation being replaced by the younger generation. And it's important to remember the mindset that the younger generation won't remember Egypt. They're only going to know the God that raised them. And therefore, they're going to enter the promised land knowing nothing but Yahweh. Okay, now I think I've got all my introductory comments in place. So the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, on the first of the second month, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt. And so this is 14 months after coming out of Egypt, and it's a month after the tabernacle has been constructed. And God said, take a census of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, by their families, by their fathers, by their households, or by their fathers' households, according to the number of names, every male, head by head, from 20 years old and upward, whoever is able to go out to war in Israel, you and Aaron shall number them by their armies. With you, moreover, there shall be a man of each tribe, each one head of his father's household. So in other words, what he's saying is go through the 12 tribes, take one man for each tribe, who's going to be the head of that tribe, who's going to be responsible for taking the census and taking the count and reporting back to you. Now, God does not just leave it up to Moses who to pick. I find this next section, though I can't pronounce all the names, I find it fascinating that even in this detail, God did not say, Moses, go pick 12 men, one from each tribe, and put them to the work. The same way that when it came time to build the tabernacle, God named by name the workmen who would do the work. Now God says, now these are the names of the men that are going to stand with you. That means that out of the millions of people in Israel, God knew everybody by name and was able to call people by name. What did we just read on Sunday? Jesus speaking of himself as the Good Shepherd. One of the things he said the Good Shepherd does with his sheep is call them out by name. It's a very personal relationship, but as I keep saying, this is how God's always been. God knows those that are his, and he doesn't just know them in general. He doesn't just know his people as an amorphous mass. He knows his people individually by name. And that's really good to know. That's a God like that can actually write names in the Lamb's Book of Life because he knows you by name. And then in the book of Revelation, once he does redeem you, he gives you a new name. Oh, well, that's even more fun. Then these are the names of those who are going to stand with you. From the tribe of Reuben, Eliezer, who is the son of Shadur, or Shadur, one of those two. Of Simeon, Shelumiel, the son of Zurishaddai. Of Judah, Nashon, the son of Aminadab. Of Issachar, Nethanel, the son of Zuar. Of Zebulun, Eliab, the son of Helon. Of the sons of Joseph, of Ephraim, Elishama, the son of Ammihud, and of Manasseh, Gamaliel, the son of Padazur, of Benjamin, Abidan, the son of Gideoni, of Dan, Ahiezer, the son of Amishaddai, of Asher, Pagiel, the son of Akron, of Gad, Eliasaph, who is the son of Deul, of Naphtali, Ahira, the son of Enan. These are they who shall be called of their congregations, the leaders of their fathers' tribes. They will be the heads of divisions of Israel. So Moses and Aaron took these men who had been designated by name, and they assembled all the congregation together on the first of the second month. Then they registered by the ancestry in their families, by their father's household, according to the number of names, from 20 years old and upward, head by head. Just as the Lord had commanded Moses, so he numbered them in the wilderness of Sinai. Now the sons of Reuben, Israel's firstborn, their genealogical registration by their families, by their father's households, according to the number of names, head by head, every male from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war, their numbered men of the tribe of Reuben were 46,500. Now, as we go through these numbers, recognize that this is the number of men above 20 years of age. Double that for women, and then add children to it. So these numbers are going to be pretty close into that 50,000 range in general, some down to 40, some up to 70. But then recognize that means there's 100,000 people per tribe in very round numbers, very roughly. That's 1.2 million in round numbers. That's why we have a pretty good feel for how many people came out of Egypt. They're still at Mount Sinai a year later, and we can easily account for 1.2 million in these numbers. Of the sons of Simeon, there are 59,300. Of the sons of Gad, there are 45,650. Of the sons of Judah, 74,600. Of the sons of Issachar, 54,400. Of the sons of Zebulun, 57,400. Of the sons of Joseph, 40,500. Of the sons of Manasseh, 32,200. I said of the sons of Joseph, particularly Ephraim was 40,500. And then Manasseh was 32,200. Of the sons of Benjamin, 35,400. Of the sons of Dan, 62,700. Of the sons of Asher, 41,500. Of the sons of Naphtali, 53,400. And then verse 44, these are the ones who were numbered, who Moses and Aaron numbered, with the leaders of Israel, 12 men, each of whom was from his father's household. So all the numbered men of the sons of Israel by their father's household, from 20 years old and upward, whoever was able to go out to war in Israel, even all the numbered men were 603,550. Now, if you assume an equal number of women, you're at 1.2 million, add children to that. And just so you get some sense of how many children, like I said, the last census, which is roughly 37, 38 years later, the numbers come out the same. That's a lot of people to be dragging through the wilderness for 40 years. Can you understand why every once in a while Moses would go, I can't do this. Enough with this. Sun up to sundown, listening to their grievances, trying to judge all the people. What a huge job this was. So, God did not leave it to just be a random group of people moving. The next thing he does, now that he's got a count, he starts laying out how the tribes are going to camp and how they're going to move. This is genuinely a military campaign to move this number of people around. Now, by the way, for those of you who were listening as I read off the numbers for each of the tribes, which of the tribes was the largest?
Dan?
How many did Judah have?
Oh, 74,000.
74,000. The largest of the tribes was the tribe of Judah. Isn't that interesting? Because what we know for sure from Israel's prophecies over his 12 sons is that Messiah is going to come through Judah. I think, just Jim speculating for a moment, I think this is just God shoring up Judah and making sure that since Messiah is going to come through Judah, that whatever else happens, Judah's strong. Judah's going to have plenty of men and plenty of children because it's through that tribe that Messiah has to come. Verse 47 then tells us the Levites, however, were not numbered among them by their father's tribes. For the Lord had spoken to Moses, saying, "Only the tribe of Levi you shall not number, nor shall you take their census among the sons of Israel. But you shall appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony, and over all its furnishings, and over all that belongs to it. They shall carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings, and they shall take care of it, and they shall also camp around the tabernacle." Now, that's the first thing that we have to recognize is that the tabernacle, sitting north to south, always sat in the midst of Israel when they camped. And then immediately around them, in four camps on each side of the tabernacle, was the Levites. Nobody, again, I've stressed this enough, nobody was allowed to go into the tabernacle. Nobody could go into the holiest place except the high priest once a year. But common folk could not go into the tabernacle. Now God has even set up a buffer of Levites all the way around the tabernacle. And then he's going to assign tribes and tell them which side of the tabernacle they're going to camp on. Like I said, like a military campaign. But even then, the common people can't just burst into God's presence. Now, when God's presence did appear as a pillar of fire or pillar of smoke, on the Day of Atonement, when the pillar would come down out of the sky, all Israel from all sides could look toward the center to the tabernacle and could observe the presence of God in their midst, very literally in the middle of them. And so God is going to use that language a lot and say, these are the people and I'm in their midst. Literally he was, and even when the pillar wasn't there, his tabernacle, his place of meeting was, and his ark was, and his law was always right there in the midst of them. And the Levites had to take care of the tent, fold it up, move it, protect it, and camp all the way around it. And look at the reason, verse 53. But the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of the testimony, that there may be no wrath on the congregation of the sons of Israel. In other words, I'm setting up a buffer zone between my holiness and the children of Israel. Because the children of Israel, though they're mine, though I've chosen them, though I'm in their midst, they're still sinful. They're still sinful people, and I need to set up the Levites between me and them so that no wrath comes upon the children of Israel. That, by the way, shows us a very early form of mediator. Mediation, somebody between you and God. I keep saying sinners cannot just go to a holy God or to where a holy God is. You can't just burst into heaven and say, I'm here. You have to have somebody between you and God making it okay between you and God, or else the only thing you can receive from God is wrath. And the only thing Israel could have potentially gotten from God in their midst was wrath, and so he set up a buffer between him and the children of Israel, and he used the Levites to do that, and then he consecrates the Levites so that they can work as a buffer between him and the children of Israel. Thus the sons of Israel did, according to that which the Lord had commanded Moses, so they did. Now the Lord said to Moses and to Aaron, the sons of Israel shall camp, each by his own standard, that means his own flag or the mark of his own tribe, with the banners of their father's households, they shall camp around the tent of meeting at a distance. Set back, put up the buffer, I'll be in your midst, but stay back, I'm a holy God. Now those who camp on the east side toward the sunrise shall be the standard of the camp of Judah by his armies, and the leaders of the sons of Judah, who are Nahshon, the son of Amminadab, and his armies, and their numbered men, 74,600. And those who camp next to him will be Issachar and the leaders of Issachar and the tribe of Zebulun. Charlie, come here. I got to get done here, so you can write on the board. So on the east side, write Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun.
And Zebulun?
And Zebulun, yep. That means that the total number of people over there, write this number down, the total number of people in the camp of Judah, that whole thing is called the camp of Judah, that side over there, 186,400 fighting men on that side.
186,400.
186,400. On the south side shall be the standard of the camp of Reuben. So write that down. Next to him, the tribe of Simeon. And next to him, the tribe of Gad. and his army. The total of numbered men of the camp of Reuben is 151,450. Now, I'm doing this on purpose because I want you to put shoe leather on these numbers for a moment. This is just the number of men over 20 camping to each side of the tent of meeting that sits in the middle of the camp. I want you to think about the size of this camp for a moment. Then the tent of the meeting shall set out with the camp of the Levites. On the west side shall be the camp of Ephraim and his armies. Next to him will be his brother Manasseh and the tribe of Benjamin. The total number of men, according to verse 24, of the camp of Ephraim is 108,100. Then on the north side should be the camp of Dan, with him Asher, and with him Naphtali. And the total of the numbered men of the camp of Dan was 157,600. These are the numbered men of the sons of Israel by their fathers' households. The total of the numbered men of the camps by their armies is 603,550, and that's not counting Levites. Do you get a feel for this? I mean, when we say God led Israel through the wilderness, don't get the picture that you saw in like the Ten Commandments movie, where, you know, they hired 1,000 extras and people went, ooh. A million people. In the air of 1,000,002, 1,000,003. Thank you, Charlie. Very well done. We're nearly done here. I wanted to get at least through this so that we understand the size of the camp. That's why God could not just say, okay, pull up stakes, we're going. You have to move 1,000,000 people and feed them in the process and make sure there's water in the process. Do you realize this is the number of people that got water out of a rock? This is the number of people that God feeds every day. Every day. Food enough for all of them. And yet, they'll get to the edge of the land of milk and honey and go, oh, I don't think so. Oh, that looks difficult. Verse 33 says, the Levites, however, were not numbered among the sons of Israel, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Thus the sons of Israel did, according to all that the Lord commanded Moses. So they camped by their standards, and so they set out, every one by his family, according to his father's household. In other words, they didn't move out as a group. They moved out by families. They moved out by tribes. They moved out in troops. They moved out in lines. God was not leaving any of this to people to decide where they would jump up and go. He made sure that the whole group moved like a military campaign. So next week, we will pick up at chapter 3. I think that gave us a good foothold in the beginning of the book of Numbers. We'll pick up at chapter 3 and talk about the Levites becoming the priests and then God redeeming all the firstborn of Israel by taking the Levites to himself. So everything that I said about it tonight and introduced tonight on that concept, hold on to for a week, and we'll revisit all that next week. And as we work our way through the book of Numbers, we're going to see the Israelites get to the edge of the promised land, and then 37 years in the wilderness, and then finally a new numbering, and then God's going to go back and review. And that's the book of Deuteronomy. Okay, this generation now that wasn't at Mount Sinai. You're all little kids running around. You don't remember all the rules. Let's review. And before he takes them into the promised land, we get the book of Deuteronomy and all the rules again. And then they get to enter the promised land through Joshua. And that's why after the first five books, you get into Joshua, and then God gives them the judges, and then you're into Ruth. If Jesus tarries, we'll get all of that covered too. If he doesn't tarry, we can just ask him when we get there. So it works out well.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.